You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. We'll talk Braves. We'll be taking a look at Julio Teheran, Alex Wood, and the back of the rotation. When we talk Marlins, we'll be taking a look at Giancarlo Stanton's injury and its consequences as the nine-waiver trade deadline approaches. We'll take a look at Steven Matz and prospects, pitching prospects in that Mets organization, as well as John Neese's status. When we talk Phillies, we'll be looking at all angles of the Andy McPhail announcement. And when we talk Washington Nationals, we'll be taking an in-depth look at the bullpen, as well as getting updates on Ryan Zimmerman and Anthony Rendon. Bill, Drew Storen has been really, really good for this team this year. A couple little hiccups in recent weeks, but overall, he's been excellent. But when you look at the rest of the Nationals bullpen, What do you see? Is that a unit that's good enough, or is that a unit that maybe could still use some help?
I think the bullpen is average. I think he can use another arm in there. David Carpenter has been pretty good. Trinan, it looks like he's getting ready to be better. But I think maybe one more arm would do, maybe in the late innings. And I think the Nationals could get another arm before the deadline.
Carpenter's an interesting name because he was quite good the past 2 years. Had a rough 18 innings with the Yankees, but, you know, it's not like nobody in the world's ever had a rough 18 innings. Do they think maybe they've got a find there? Do they think he might be stealthily a really nice pickup?
I think so, Matthew. You know, I spoke to Carpenter the other day, and, you know, I asked him what happened with the Yankees, and it seems like he really didn't know his role over there. And once he arrived in Washington, you know, he's been almost lights out. I mean, he gave up a run recently. But other than that, he's been really productive for them. So, I mean, he knows his role. He knows he's going to be one of the late-inning guys. And I think that's been a big help for him.
Is there anybody knocking on the door, either in the minors or I guess only in the minors, anyone knocking on the door to be a bigger part of that mix? I guess what I'm saying is there anybody internally, either currently pitching low leverage innings or pitching in the minors, that might, as this evolves, be a bigger part of the late inning mix?
No, as of right now, no. But, like Adam Barrett, who is on the disabled list, he's coming close to returning. So, he's been throwing. He's going to be pitching at Potomac real soon. So hopefully when he gets back, you know, he'll be back to normal like he was last year, and because he's not having a good year at all. So once he comes back, hopefully he can be productive for them.
I want to talk a little about Casey Jansen, who to me is a really interesting guy. And we talked to him when they signed him. He's not a high 90s guy by any stretch, but he's not striking out anybody. And you could strike guys out without throwing high 90s. And so what I wonder is, has he been what they expected, or is he maybe not quite what they hoped he would be?
I think it's the latter. I mean, obviously, he hasn't pitched in big, big innings the way Carpenter has. But and why that is, I mean, well, he started the season on the disabled list, and I guess they're slowly trying to have him come back from the injury, I guess. But that's pretty much it. He hasn't been seeing a lot of action, to be honest with you. And I just think they're starting him off slowly, and that's the way I see it.
The idea when he was brought in was that he was going to be basically the eighth inning guy, wasn't it?
That's correct. That's correct. And that really hasn't happened because we've seen Trinan and Carpenter pretty much as the guys. So how he fits in, it's going to be interesting the rest of the way. Now, he only has a one-year deal. So, I mean, he's going to have to really step it up after the All-Star break for sure.
And, look, again, I understand that we're not talking about a 98-mile-an-hour guy. I get that. But his velocity is down significantly even from last year. His average fastball, according to Fangraphs, is 87.5, which is almost unheard of even for a right-handed starter, never mind a right-handed reliever. Are they convinced that he is all the way back healthy, or is he still, even though he's off the DL, is he still sort of building back to where he wants to be just as far as strength and physical health?
I think he's building back. That's the way Matt Williams operates. I mean, he's not going to put people in right away once they come off the disabled list and everything. And I think in terms of Jansen, he's really I think he's building him back. And I think by the second half we'll see more of him, but hopefully he'll be more productive, and that's pretty much it.
It's funny, one of the names that has been mentioned with the Nationals so far this year is Tyler Clippard, which would certainly be an amusing and an odd addition. Do you think that has any legs? Do you think Clippard is a guy they sincerely might add, or is that something that isn't going to happen?
Well, you know, it wouldn't surprise me because, you know, when you look at some of the work of the bullpen this year, you wonder why they let him go. Now, I know why they let him go. First of all, he's going to be a free agent after this year. And I guess they felt that he pitched a lot of innings, which he did. But, you know, there was no sign of, like he was going to go downhill or in any way. Now, obviously, he's not getting the saves in Oakland like he had the chance here. But it wouldn't surprise me if they did get another eighth inning guy to help Drew Storen out. And, I mean, there's no question they do miss Kyle Clipper. There's no doubt.
Would they be able and willing to take on reasonable amount of money if they were to make a move, or are they in a position where that wouldn't be likely?
Well, it depends. It's hard to say because, you know, obviously the Nationals are known for their budget, to keep their budget. So I don't know, that might be hard, but it depends. It depends on who they give up in return, and I wouldn't be surprised to see Clippers there. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the thing. You know, we're not. It's one thing if you need to add a starter or a big bat. You can't add a reliever without breaking the bank. So I guess maybe to some extent what we're looking at here is they're not going to take on Papelbon, but they also don't need to be cash neutral. Is that probably a decent way to look at it?
That's right. I would say so. And, it really depends. I think they need a guy who can really help. I don't, you know, like you mentioned Papelbon. I don't think Papelbon would be a good fit for them because he's a closer, and you already have one in Storen. And you have Clipper, who's been the eighth inning guy for the Nationals for like several years. So I think he would be the best fit.
To move to other parts of the club, it seems like a couple of guys are getting closer, and this team is once again approaching being healthy. Where is Anthony Rendon at as he attempts to come back from his injury?
Well, even though he's on the DL, he's still swinging the bat. And I expect him maybe to start a rehab probably within a week or maybe two. But right now, I mean, that's a good sign that he's able to swing the bat. That's why he's traveling with the team right now. So that's a good sign. Ryan Zimmerman, he's working out in Potomac. He's close to a rehab assignment. And hopefully he'll be back, hopefully before the All-Star break, and we'll see what happens.
That's a really, to start with, it's an unbelievably painful injury. But that's also an injury that tends to linger. What's their level of confidence that once he comes back, he's good to go and won't be dealing with this for the remainder of the year?
Well, right now they're confident because he's swinging the bat. He's doing baseball activities. Now, if he wasn't doing that, then that would be, you know, a bad sign. But right now they think it's slowly going away. And, I mean, the key really is to start running. I mean, it's not so much swinging the bat or fielding his position because I saw him do that. So if he can run, then everything will be okay. It depends on how he does in the rehab assignment, and hopefully he'll be back soon because they need his bat in there.
First of all, you're proud of me for resisting a New York Mets joke that 1,000 people have already made.
Or Steven Batts or Meet the Mets. There's a lot of ways you can go with that. So, yes, I am proud of you.
So I was looking, and the Mets in 2013, 2014, 2015 are not the first team or anywhere close to it to have a slew of really exciting pitching prospects in the high minors and knocking on the door and even get to the majors. In fact, it's not the first Mets team to do that. And yet, it's so far it's working. These guys are not only getting through, they're getting there and they've got some ability. And they got major league ability. There's a string of guys who can get big league hitters out. And so it got me to wondering, just kind of broadly, what are the Mets doing right to turn pitching prospects into major league pitchers at what right now is a much better than average rate?
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly point to the development in the minors. I mean, we've spent plenty of time knocking the Mets for their inability to develop a position player. I mean, really, they haven't developed a really, really good one since David Wright, and that was well over a decade ago. But they have had lots of success developing pitchers. You know, Steven Matz was a project from the start. He was a second-round draft pick out of high school. He threw hard, didn't really have a lot else to offer in terms of major league-ready skills at the time, and he's come along. I mean, you know about the arm injuries. He had a Tommy John surgery. He had some other things going on that he didn't throw a professional pitch until a couple of years after the Mets drafted him, but they stuck with him, and it worked. You know, you see Matt Harvey is another great success story, obviously. A guy who most scouts thought had the ceiling of a number two coming up, and as soon as he hit the majors, he was anything but. So, well, you know, we have knocked Sandy Alderson's regime for not drafting, you know, a ton of guys who have helped out so far. We've knocked them, you know, there's been a lot of jokes thrown around. Well, you know, they can thank Omar Minaya for drafting Matt Harvey, for drafting Steven Matz. But the truth is this regime has developed those guys, and there is something to that. How much, I don't know. At the end of the day, it's on those guys, the Matt Harveys and the Jacob DeGroms and the Steven Matzes and everyone else to actually make a legitimate step forward. But this team, for whatever reason, has had much more success developing pitchers from the farm system than hitters, and Steven Matz is just the latest example.
This is admittedly nothing more than spitballing, but I wonder when there's some frustration developing hitters and such success developing pitchers, is there any thought that maybe that much derided AAA environment ultimately helps the pitchers, that guys who can survive there and endure Las Vegas and the PCL in general, maybe that's part of why they're successfully developing pitchers?
I mean, there's definitely a little something to the fact that if a guy can have success in the PCL, especially at Las Vegas, at that ballpark, you know, chances are he's going to be able to have success in the majors. You take anything on both sides of the ball, you take with a grain of salt there. I'm not sure how much it plays into this whole thing, because most of the guys, probably with the exception of Jacob DeGrom, who have come up, spent very little time at Las Vegas. You know, Matt Harvey spent time at Buffalo even before the Mets were affiliated with Vegas. And then, you know, Matt has essentially had half a year at Vegas. Noah Syndergaard didn't have all that much time at Vegas before he spent up. Really, the development, what's making these guys from projects, from draft picks, from talents to major league pitchers and guys who could potentially be major league stars is what's going on at the lower levels of the minors soon after these guys are drafted, where they're really learning those extra pitches, where they're learning how to pitch, and so on and so forth. By the time these guys get to AAA, get to Las Vegas, and get to that environment, you know, that learning curve, they're almost at the end of it. So I'm not sure how much stock that plays in, but certainly if you can go out and have success there, it's a pretty good harbinger for things to come.
Are they doing anything different, innovative, out-of-the-box, instruction-wise, in the lower minors?
Not really. You know, what they're doing is they've drafted a lot of pitchers recently. And, you know, that even goes back into the Omar Minaya era. And, you know, it's a numbers game. Sandy Alderson has been very, very adamant that he's not trading any of these top-flight pitchers, and he has been for some time. So they've basically hung on to all their highest-level arms. And you know, for the guys who have panned out, there's been plenty who haven't. You know, they've had plenty of guys over the years who, in the lower levels, had just as good of track records or just as much potential as the guys who have made it. You know, the difference being these guys did make it, and by the time they got to AA, AAA, they were considered some of the 10, 20, 30, 50, whatever best prospects in the league. There's nothing necessarily innovative the Mets are doing at the lower levels. They're just, you know, they're hanging on to all these guys, and the number game seems to be working out for them. And, yeah, that development staff is doing a good job with them. There's no question about it.
And, you know, that's kind of the other interesting thing to me about this is that, I mean, Harvey was for 1 year a top 10 prospect, but by and large, and was a top 10 draft pick, I should say, and was 1 year a very highly regarded prospect. But by and large, these are not, to use an unfortunate example right now, Dylan Bundy types. These are not the guys who are top 20 the day they're drafted, top 20 prospects the day they're drafted, top 20 all the way through. And Mats in particular put up some really nice numbers coming up, and it wasn't even rated a top 100 prospect until this year. What was it that started clicking for him to go from a guy who was dominating really low minors hitters to being a guy that people said, oh, wait, this guy is going to be a really special big league pitcher?
Really, it's the cop-out answer, but for Steven Matz, the huge biggest thing was just being healthy. He had huge health issues early in his professional career, and he came back in 2013, really, and put up some really nice numbers in the low minors, but you think to yourself, okay, when is he going to get hurt again, and let's see it at the upper minors. And then you know, you look up at the end of last year, and he had done it at the upper minors, and he was healthy for the entire season, and now you're coming into this year, and you see a guy who has just as good of stuff as some of those other, you know, big-time prospects the Mets have called up. He's doing it from the left side, and now all of a sudden he's able to handle a major league workload in terms of number of innings per year, and you know, with that stuff. So more than anything, it's health for him. Obviously, developing the secondary pitches was key for him, as is key for anyone. You know, you really like that high 70s sharp curveball that he throws, and all that, but you know, the skill set was there for him. He was a project in terms of command. He's gotten that down, and really he has at least, you know, average big league command right now. But those are all things that are part of the development process. Some guys get it, some guys don't. The fact that Steven Matz has been able to do it and come this quickly is really just a product of his health.
To switch to some more experienced Mets pitching, rumors are now swirling around John Neese. He seems like maybe the natural guy to move because he's got some value and they now have another lefty in the rotation. Might be hard to move Bartolo Colon. Is there anything to this? Is Neese a guy who could move before the deadline?
They could move, and I'm sure they'll certainly look into moving. The problem with, I'm just not sure how much value there is that you're going to get for him at this point. And it's the same thing, you know, we've talked about so many of these guys. We've talked about Dylan G. We've talked about Bartolo Colon back in the offseason. These guys who, you know, have pretty decent to even good at times track records in the big leagues, but they don't have a lot of external value. If I'm a scout for another team and I'm looking at John Neese and I'm looking at that fastball that's sometimes in the mid-80s and I'm looking at his track record and, you know, he had a really bad month of May before turning around in June, and even now in June it's not anything electric. I'm not sure there's a lot of teams out there that are going to be willing to give up a huge, huge piece for him or even a big piece for John Neese. So with all that being said, I think the Mets are going to look down and see, well, we're not getting offered that much. And having John Neese around as a guy who you can pencil in or even write in ink for 190 innings or so, that's pretty big when we're looking at this six-man rotation, looking at trying to limit the innings of Mats and Syndergaard and Harvey and DeGrom and so on and so forth. So while the Mets, you know, have these big four young pitchers, they still have Bartolo Colon. They still have even Dylan G down in the minors if they need something in a pinch. And John Neese is definitely expendable in that sense. I just don't think they're going to get the value they need to pull the trigger on a deal like that.
One last thing, because you did just mention the six-man rotation. That is back on again. What reason is there to think, or is there reason to think, that it's going to be better received within the clubhouse this time around?
Well, it sounds like this time around, as opposed to last time, it wasn't a, here, come into my office, let's discuss this and let's talk about your concerns. It was a, here, come into my office, this is what we're doing, which is really what it probably should have been the first time. It should have been more a, this is our plan. I don't care if you're on board because you're on this team, so you have to be on board. Now, it can still change. This is the Mets, of course, and I wouldn't be surprised if it does change at some point. A trade, an injury, anything like that could alter this plan. But I just think the Mets are being a lot more firm with it this time. They're not playing around. They've drawn out the pitching rotation essentially for the rest of the year. And if they hadn't turned to it right now, guys like Noah Syndergaard in particular, Jacob deGrom, would be in trouble with their innings. And the Mets just are not willing to do that at this point. So it's just a matter of doing what they say more than ever right now.
Mark, you kind of knew coming up on this stretch of schedule that it would tell a lot about the Braves, and they're still fairly early in a fairly tough stretch, but I think it's fair to say it's been pretty sobering. How does this little slide here recently change the way, because we've talked a good bit about how they approach the deadline, buyer, seller, probably not conventionally either one, but as they've fallen a little further out and the odds look a little longer, how does it change the way they view the next month?
I think what it does is probably prevents them from being conflicted as we approach the trade deadline. As you said, this has been a very tough stretch with Uribe. They've played within a 9-game stretch. They faced the Nationals and Pirates, and right before that, they were very fortunate that their pitching proved to be strong enough against the Mets' three starters when they threw Harvey, Syndergaard, and DeGrom at them there in that series. They ended up sweeping that, and at that point in time, they're 500. People say, oh, you know, maybe. Well, if nothing else, this stretch has probably confirmed that this is, you know, a 500 team at best, a team that has improved from an organizational standpoint significantly when you look at their pipeline. And I think if they would have stayed 500, stayed in contention there, you know, they might have been conflicted with, you know, okay, do we give up a piece here or there just to make a run at things, you know, in July. So I think that maybe, you know, this might have been a blessing in disguise, if nothing else.
Last week, you mentioned, not that they would be shopping them, but you mentioned both Cameron Maben and Julio Teheran and maybe even Jose Peraza as potential trade pieces. How do they view guys like that as they approach the deadline, and in the case particularly of Teheran and Maben, are those guys, if they were to move, maybe more off-season pieces than July pieces?
Yeah, I think that those are pieces that you're open to moving in July, but at the same time, you take a step back and realize that you're probably going to get much more value for them, or maybe there will be much more access to the kind of player that you're looking for them, because these are not players you're just moving to move. I mean, it's not like you're moving contracts. You're not, you know, Teheran has certainly struggled. While Maben's value has risen this year, Teheran's has decreased. But the reason you're going to be moving these guys is you need a power bat in this lineup. They do not have a power bat coming anytime soon at the minor league level. We've talked about Braxton Davidson being the next in line, and he's at low A right now. So he's a few years away. They need to go get a power bat to put in this lineup, not only to you know, just to provide some home run potential, but to provide some protection for Freddie Freeman when he is over the next few years. That maximizes his value. So I do expect that if they're going to make move one of those guys, the best option to find what you're looking for in exchange would come during the off season.
Has the view on Teheran tilted at all? We spent a lot of this year talking about how puzzling he was, how sometimes he's good and sometimes he's bad. And I think the sort of broad descriptor that we've used talking about Teheran this year is just puzzling, confusing what's going on. Is that starting to tilt to maybe there's just really is just something wrong here?
Yeah, you know, it is very confusing to look at all his splits, the home road splits, and I haven't put a lot of bearing on those. This week I touched on it in a story I wrote, just because I was thinking it might have just been coincidence, but it, you know, you've got the home road splits, you've got, you know, two mediocre starts to compare, and then all of a sudden there's a pretty good one. I think at the end of the day, what we need to remember is this. The only thing we can deduce from what Teheran has done this year is he's not going to be an ace. He is, and I think there's a lot of people that would have told you that before the season. He is a legitimate number two. Maybe he's more like a number three, number four, which, you know, that he still has some value. What I think, why has this happened? you know, early in his minor league career when he was touted as one of the top pitching prospects, he'd throw 94, 95. That arm strength has gone away. He seems to – I've talked to some former pitchers, and there's been a few that hang around here, you know, that have talked – that said they just think he's lost his identity when he started relying so heavily on the two-seam fastball. He started shying away from the four-seamer. The two-seamer has not been anywhere near as effective this year, especially when you look at what left-handers have done against him. That pitch has run over the middle of the plate. You know, here's a kid who – he's still just 24 years old. Can he be an effective pitcher at the big league level for many years to come? Yes. You just, from a Braves perspective, when they're looking to deal him, they have to ask the question is, where is his value going to go? Right now, you feel like you would be selling low on him. But, you know, as I mentioned recently, you just have to wonder if that value is ever going to come up. Because, you know, recent history here in Atlanta, we saw what happened with Jair Jurgens and Tommy Hansen. I'm not saying that Teron is on that same exact path, but you do have to, evaluate the possibility that his value could drop significantly, just like theirs did, and not come back.
On the flip side, there's a lot of encouragement here lately about Alex Wood, and he's such an interesting guy to me because he's done nothing but succeed at the big league level, and yet I think for a long time there was still this, how long does he keep doing it? Yeah, is he really a frontline starter for the long term? And it seems like just hearing people talk about him, just reading what you and other people write about him, again, this is a guy where it seems like maybe the narrative is changing a little bit. Maybe there is a little more belief that, hey, maybe this really is what Alex Wood is going to be. Is that a kind of accurate way to describe what he's doing this year?
I think the doubts about his potential as a starter certainly have, evaporated. I think people are starting to buy into it. You know, when he first started, made an impression of spring training, you asked scouts, this is his very first spring training, and they said, oh, that delivery, I don't know, he's going to, you know, he may be an injury risk. Okay. Well, look, they're all injury risks. We've seen clean deliveries. We've seen sloppy deliveries. They there's always a risk there. He's gone through 50 starts. And one thing I have got to know about Alex Wood is he is a great competitor. When he went to the University of Georgia, he was not, you know, maybe not the most highly touted guy. His first career start in college, he goes up against Garrett Cole, ends up, Georgia wins that game. Garrett Cole was going to be drafted number one overall a few months later. He's a guy who, you know, he doesn't necessarily pitch with a chip on his shoulder, but at the same time, he likes to prove his doubters wrong. He worked on his mechanics, you know, in front of a mirror for between his sophomore and junior season there at Georgia. When he explains it, how he used a towel and just went through everything, because look, he understands his delivery is awkward, but what he wanted to do was say, hey, look, if I get to the same exact point, doesn't matter how I get there, but if I get to that point where my release point is lined up, where my leg is where a traditional delivery would be, my arm's going to be, he worked on that for hours and days, weeks, whatever, during that year and made himself a better pitcher. I think here's a guy who definitely has the potential. Right now I'd say he's a solid number three. Has the potential to be a very effective number two for many years to come. You hear just because of the delivery, and I don't want to put him in this category, but that deceptive delivery of Chris Sale, that adds to some of his success. So, like I said, I'm not putting him in Chris Sale's category, but that does has helped him, the deception within his delivery.
And that's one of the things we learn more and more about is that velocity certainly matters, but when you start picking up that velocity also matters a lot. There's still, as of now, some question about the back of that Braves rotation. As of now, it's really only a four-man rotation. One of them is a guy who's made, I think, two big league starts. I wonder, what do they do at the back of the rotation now, and is it too soon to be thinking about Mike Foltynewicz again there?
Well, my thought on Mike Foltynewicz is that they have to get him up there. Get back up here at some point this season to get him in their eyes. Now, right now you've got a rotation of that has two rookies in it. We're with Manny Banuelos making his Major League debut there on Thursday against the Nationals. Matt Whistler just made his Major League debut 2 weeks ago. So two guys that, you know, they're going to find out who they are. Mike Foltynewicz, just like he did that 1 month before he was sent down. There were not any plans to send Foltynewicz down. You know, the Braves were going to allow him to take his lumps. But at the same time, it was basically his demotion to Gwinnett was as much for insubordination as anything, because he walked off the field during that side session at Fenway Park. And, you know, the Braves just kind of felt like, and even, you know, that wasn't the last straw. It's just when they started talking to him, they're looking in his eyes, and they're just not seeing that fire. So they had to, you know, use one of their weapons, which was obviously send the kid down. And he had some things to work on. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. He had some things to work on. But I think they would have allowed him to continue to work on those things at the big league level, knowing that there would be some inconsistency. But at some point this year, yeah, I do think that they have to get him back up here. Where he fits in the rotation probably depends on how not only Whistler will perform. You got Banuelos, who will make a few starts and then probably go to the bullpen because he's on an innings limit. It will be influenced on how Williams Perez comes back from his foot injury. But at the same time, I think if you're looking long-term future, who you want to look at down the stretch, obviously I think that though Williams Perez has been very successful, I think that they'll probably tend to want to try to give Foltynewicz every chance he can if there is an opening, or if you know, Perez gives them a reason to remove him from the rotation there after the break.
Joe, a team that really thought things were about to start turning up, it's about to get its best news of the year in 24 hours or so, got some really bad news recently. Giancarlo Stanton out apparently for 4 to 6 weeks. Is your understanding that that's pretty reasonable? That's about what they're looking at?
Yeah, Matthew. The best case scenario would probably be 3 weeks. But, you know, with the team, you know, not really heading in the direction of playoffs and the urgency to rush anything, it's kind of away. So I think you err on the side of caution and you try to get him back in a month at the earliest. And it is. It's sad, not just, you know, for an organization, but for a player and for the industry and the fans, that this guy is having a potentially historical type season. And, you know, all of a sudden now he's shelved for at least a month. And, you know, there's a lot of numbers that probably aren't going to be what they could have been had he stayed healthy.
Excuse me. Does this change how they view the deadline? Does this change how they look at the next 4 weeks?
Well, yes. I mean, in a nutshell, yes. I mean, they were kind of right before that. The team kind of had a 10-day window to kind of really, you know, track in the right way. And, you know, they already had people dispatch looking in other organizations for potential trade pieces. So, yeah, I mean, you lose a guy like Stanton, you lose kind of the heart of your team as well. But, you know, I think that the moves that they were going to make probably, and what I still think they are going to make, are probably what would have been even if Stanton had stayed healthy and Jose comes in and does what he's doing. You know, barring them going on like a 10-game winning streak, you know, I think they were tracking towards, you know, moving some of the parts that they don't anticipate being here next year, keeping the core together, you know, because this really was a 15, 16, 17 vision in terms of the core. And I don't think they're ready to break the core up, but, you know, to become a buyer, certainly a no. To become a full-fledged seller, a no. But to make moves that to move forward, I think that's where they are.
Part of the problem here is that one of the most intriguing guys, I would think, one of the guys that might draw a lot of interest on the market, is not currently able to play. What's the read on Martin Prado?
Yeah, and it's true, and I'm not sure he's going to be back until after the All-Star break. You know, after that shoulder, he banged it up pretty good, that AC joint. He played catch for the first time yesterday. He's been swinging the bat. He's been fielding, just not testing the arm throwing. And until that's there, you know, he's not on the field. But from what I'm hearing, it's going to really take something to move him away. They got him under contract next year, and from what I understand, there's not the third base market is not really looking really is pretty thin going into the offseason. So, you know, Prado is kind of what they're looking for and hoping to build around. And, you know, they're liking what they're seeing from Derek Dietrich in a spot situation, but aren't ready to turn the reins over to him. And so I anticipate Prado being a Marlin, even if he had stayed healthy, because he's just kind of what they were looking for. They've been wanting to get this guy for several years. And with the Yankees picking up $3 million of his $11 million next year as well, not a real lot of incentive unless there's a real overpay. And I'm not sure who's going to overpay for Martin Prado.
Would Latos and Heron be the most compelling guys that they might move then?
Yeah, and probably that order. You know, I think Latos is priority number one. If they can move him, and, you know, they may have to eat some of that, you know, that contract. He is throwing a little bit better of late, and he's, you know, obviously in a walk year. So he's the guy, you know, they got young arms. They want to see how they do. So clearing a rotation spot makes a lot of sense for them as well. So, you know, they have been trying, you know, they've been, you know, kind of, you know, for at least a couple of weeks, you know, seeking inquiries and possible matches for Matt Latos. And I think that interest will kind of continue between now and July 31st.
Is Heron potentially a complicated guy to move just because, look, I know he's not going to quit if he gets traded. He doesn't want to go somewhere. He doesn't want to go midseason. But at the same time, he is a guy with some pretty clear preferences about where he wants to be. Is he maybe a little more challenging to find a good fit for?
I don't think for what you're saying. From what I understand, I would be really shocked if a trade was made and he didn't report, you know, that type of thing. Especially, you know, this guy conceivably could be in his last year. You know, he may retire after the year. So, you know, if it's not working out in Miami, is this how he wants to go out, you know, on a team that's just kind of being a mentor on the team in the second half that may not be as good as he wants? And I think he would kind of embrace going to a chance to pitch for a contender. From the Marlins standpoint, if there's a good offer out there, I'm sure they would do it. But he's a little more interesting than Latos in the fact that he's a free player in for the Marlins. He goes to the Dodgers are paying the $10 million on his contract. So still a little unclear if he were moved, who pays, you know, takes up the remaining. That's kind of an unanswered question right now. But that may factor into it. But I think the Marlins could be, I'm sure they're taking calls on him, and there's a strong chance he could be moved. He's also a guy, Matthew, I think might be an August move if it's not a July move.
It's sort of interesting to think, you know, one team that actually really could use a starting pitcher and supposedly is kicking the tires in the starting pitching market is those very same Los Angeles Dodgers. Would they be interested in a reunion after a brief away time? And I guess the bigger question is, how would that affect, or would it, that financial arrangement?
Yeah, it's real interesting. From what I understand, I would be kind of more shocked if the Dodgers did. I don't know why, but I just don't think there's the fit to go back there. That's just kind of the indications I was getting. Now, obviously, things can change as urgencies come along, but you're absolutely right. That would make a ton of sense, but I just don't think the fit's there. I don't know whether it's a personal thing or just kind of the experience wasn't great for both sides, that type of thing. I'm not sure, but I would be kind of stunned if Latos went back to L.A. And I also think teams like L.A. are going to be looking for Hamels, and
sure,
you know, that's also going to play into play, too. I mean, some of these teams are, you know, a guy like Heron and Latos to some degree, you're going to see what happens with Cueto and Hamels. You know, they're going to be the second-tier type of guys. So, you know, that's why I think that both of those guys could be later this month, right around the deadline. And Cole Hamels obviously is going to, and Johnny Cueto obviously going to kind of swing how the between now and the 31st looks.
Yeah, it's a weird market because some years those might be two of the top three or four starting pitchers in the market, but as you note, this year they are not. To move to the actual 2015 Marlins, Justin Nicolino gets sent down, but I get the impression they liked what they saw. What was their take on what they saw from Nicolino during his brief stint with the big club?
Yeah, absolutely, they did like what they see. And the thing about Nicolino, Matt, I think we might have touched on this before, that he kind of is what he's going to be. There's not a ton of ceiling there. So it's, you know, he's a savvy, you know, good off-speed, you know, or change of speed, heady left-hander who could reach mid-90s but doesn't really live there. And he kind of saw in the second start against the Dodgers, you elevate just a little bit. You could get hit around a little bit harder than maybe in AAA. So it's all about with him patience and perfection and as much technique as he can get those innings. You know, they got to figure a way to get Cozar back in rotation up here. He could stay right now, but, you know, he has the options. They don't really need to rush him. Probably save a little bit of service time in the process. You know, let him go down to AAA, probably spends the whole month there, and they'll see how the rotation sorts out, whether trading reaches a Kohler type of situation as well. But, you know, we just mentioned two guys that could be out of here, and if that's the case, you know, you're going to see Justin Nicolino, you know, in this rotation probably in August all the way to the end until Lake Feely's reached, you know, an innings limit.
And what do they do with Jared Cosart, who, as of now, as I understand it, is still not officially been reinstated to the rotation?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, they got six guys right now in their rotation, six guys on their pitching staff for five spots, and they say they're not going for a six starter between now and the All-Star break. And that's, I'm saying that, you know, with the addition of Jose Fernandez on Thursday. So, yeah, right now it hasn't officially been said who's going to start the Cubs series over the weekend. And unless there is a trade a little more imminent than they're letting on, I think Cozart might again be in the bullpen. It just depends on what they do with Jose Urania. You know, if they want him up here or the same boat as Nicolino, let him go down to AAA, get Cozart here, see what he's got. Because, you know, moving forward, this guy, Matthew, in spring training, he was going to be the number two starter until he had his little issues at the end of spring training, including the blister and the other little problem he had. He was going to be the number two starter, and he ended up being five only because that's how he came back from the blister and what else. And
Todd, you continue to have one of the most interesting seasons anybody's covered in an awfully long time. A lot of interesting stuff to me to unpack in the hiring of Andy MacPhail. And I'm not entirely sure where to start, but I think one of the things that drew a lot of attention from a lot of people was the talk of analytics. I don't think anybody thinks the Phillies are going to turn into an organization like the Rays or even the Pirates, who are really aggressively starting to use analytical stuff, even in the day-to-day running of the club, even in in-game managing. But I also think it's pretty clear that they are near, if not at the bottom, of all major league clubs as far as mixing some sort of statistical data with the scouting. So I'm wondering, I guess as much as anything, I'm wondering if you, just based on what we know right now, can sort of enlighten people as to how exactly they plan to go from a team that uses almost none of that to a team that at least incorporate some combination, to use the expression that Dane Perry used. The question is not stats or scouting. That's like asking beer or tacos. The answer is both, you fool.
You know, they're going to definitely get into it a lot more, I think. And we saw the other day at the press conference where they introduced Andy MacPhail, Phillies owner John Middleton. He mentioned it several times, and how we've, you know, he's saying how the Phillies have been behind and not really been slow to transition into this. And you know, they're creating their own proprietary computer system, which they're going to call Phil, which is going to help them get more involved into analytics and just using these numbers. And quite frankly, you know, it's long overdue, I think. Now they will say that, and then they've said that, you know, hey, it's not like we haven't used this at all, but they have really taken us, they've really made the point that they're a scouting organization first, and they trust their eyes more than anything else. But, you know, I think John Milton's point and Andy MacPhail's point is it doesn't hurt to look at it. And, you know, shoot, if all this information is out there, and some of it's great and some of it's kind of like, you know, how much do we want to trust it or whatever. But if the information is out there, we should at least be spending time looking into it and helping us make better baseball decisions. And you can look back at some of the decisions they've made over the last few years, where at the time you were kind of scratching your head going, why did they go after this particular person? And the answer was, well, our scouts love them. But, you know, the numbers really didn't back that up. And then, you know, the players ended up struggling. So I think it's a good step for the Phillies to really get involved in this And Andy McPhail certainly seems on board and willing to take another step forward.
Yeah, I thought one of the really interesting comments and all there, and I think it was Gillick, actually, though it may have been McPhail who said it, was if nothing else, you need to know what your opponents are doing. That even if you don't want to do it, you need to have an understanding of what the other guy is doing and how they're trying to beat you. One of the things this raises for me is, okay, so ownership's on board. Gillick's on board, and this is his second go-round. He's been with them for a while. If everybody knows this, and Ruben Amaro reports to these guys, why is this only happening now? Why did somebody not say sooner, hey, look, we're behind here. This needs to change.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. Now, they hired Scott Friedman from the commissioner's office, I think it was two springs ago, to kind of jumpstart their analytics program. They've got a couple analytics interns working for the Phillies right now. So, you know, they do have people working in this department, but in terms of really giving those guys some teeth in terms of, you know, influencing baseball decisions, I'm not sure that it's there yet. So, that's a great point. Why isn't it started earlier? You know, Ruben said the other day, kind of in the one-on-ones, his point is, listen, we've been doing this stuff, but to be perfectly honest, we had a lot of success for a lot of years doing it the other way, which was really relying on our scouts. And so we just continued to have faith in our scouts, which I guess you can kind of understand, but in my opinion, and certainly John Milton and Andy McPhail's opinion and others, you know, if the information is out there, you got to know what they're doing. And you're right. If other teams are looking at players and valuing players a certain way because of numbers, you kind of want to know how they value those players. So when it comes to trade time or whatever, free agency, whatever, you know exactly what the other team is thinking.
I thought in one of the points that you made, Paul Hagan made, a lot of people made, that was really central to this presentation was the increased public presence of ownership going forward, that it was made not just, you know, people who were there sort of said, oh, hey, not used to seeing this guy on the stage, and then they explicitly said, look, we're going to be part of this. I kind of want to read between the lines a little bit because I don't know that I heard anybody explicitly say this, but here's kind of my deduction from that is, okay, if up until now the team president, David Montgomery, more recently Pat Gillick, has been left to do all of these things and ownership has sat back, and now ownership is going to be more public and more involved in business and that kind of thing, what that says to me is that the president's job is going to be much more a baseball-exclusive job than it was before. Is that an accurate read in your mind?
Yeah, I think so. You know, John Middleton said, I believe it was in his opening remarks, that, you know, Andy McPhail is going to be president of the entire organization, but we want him to focus primarily on baseball responsibilities. And, you know, John Middleton was very forceful and very, quite frankly, I thought he was pretty impressive talking to people. I mean, because Matthew, this is a guy who people, like, it's been a mystery. The ownership group has really been a mystery. And a lot of people have been just dying to hear John Middleton's voice, quite frankly. And he's turned down multiple interview requests over the years. He did not want to speak to anybody. He wanted to remain in the background. So his first comments to come forward and to say, listen, this is the most important thing in my life right now, Phillies baseball. He turned and looked at Andy McPhail in the eye and said, Andy, anything you need, you've got it. We want to win, I'm not going to give you a budget, a set budget before every year. Say, hey, you have to work with this. You know, if you think you need something, you know, we want to make it happen. Now, I don't think this means they're going to go off and, you know, have a $400 million payroll in a few years or anything like that. But he was very forceful and commanding in terms of his willingness to kind of lead this organization and show the fan base that, hey, you know what, we're not just a silent ownership group. You know, we're out here and we're fired up and we want to win, and I'm going to help these guys any way they can to get back to winning baseball.
To what extent do you think this is in some ways almost a reflection of wounded pride? And the reason I say that is, you know, the Phillies have taken a lot of hits for how things have gone on the field, and you know, among stat geeks, and I say that not disparagingly, I am one, have taken a lot of heat for some of their decisions, but I think it's pretty clear, and you probably know this better than anybody being around them, this is an organization that, in all facets, not just baseball, prides itself on being a quality organization. This is a, sure, winning is a big deal, but this is an organization that really values having a way of doing business, doing things the right way. It means something to be the Phillies, and so I do wonder to what extent this is a reflection of them sort of being tired of being a punchline to too many people too often, just as a result of the struggles on the field sort of maybe coloring people's perception of what is a really proud organization and in a lot of ways for good reason.
Yeah, I think so, and that's one of the reasons I think that John Milton wanted to step forward and introduce Andy McPhail, and he opened like with a 5 minutes worth of remarks. You know, I think he wanted to let everybody know that, hey, everything is under control. It, you know, we're not playing well right now. It doesn't look great right now, but believe me, somebody's at the helm here. We have a very clear vision. We're very committed. So, you know, if you had any concerns that, you know, we're kind of rudderless at the moment, I'm here to let you know that you can relax. We're going to do everything we can to get the ball rolling. And I think, you know, having Andy McPhail as the next team president signified that a little bit. This guy is very highly respected in baseball circles. We know what he did with the Twins, Cubs, and Orioles. He was rumored to be a potential candidate for commissioner a few years ago. And so this is a guy with a lot of experience. And quite, I also thought he was impressive in his comments the other day. So you have two guys up there kind of saying, hey, everything's going to be okay. Maybe not this year, maybe not next year, maybe not the year after that. But in a few years, you're going to start seeing some things going right. And, you know, when it comes time to start spending money again on free agents, we're going to be doing that. And, you know, 2007 to 2011, we're going to be able to get that kind of magic back.
One last thing, and it's rather than this sort of big picture philosophical, a very kind of immediate nuts and bolts question. How exactly is this going to work this month? It's 30 days to the non-waiver trade deadline. They have a GM who doesn't really know what his future is. They have a team president who's going to be gone. They've got upper management saying things like, well, whoever the GM is, how do they proceed right over these next 30 days, which potentially will be extremely pivotal in this long-term, the long-term of the franchise?
Yeah, I asked that question to Gillick, and I asked that question to McPhail. Like, for instance, all right, say you guys have a deal on the table for Cole Hamels. Pat, you hate it. Andy, you love it. What happens at that point? And Andy McPhail's answer was, I would be very surprised if we had such differences of opinion that there was like one clearly yes, one clearly no. He doesn't really see it going down that way. Now, how I see it working is I see Ruben Amaro Jr. continuing to do his work as general manager. And what I mean by that is he will be taking phone calls from general managers. He will be making phone calls to general managers, trying to put trade packages together. When he gets those offers on the table, he will then go up to the top floor at Citizens Bank Park, get into a room with Pat and Andy McPhail and anybody else, any other, you know, top scouts, whatever, and they'll discuss these trade options. I think Andy McPhail is going to be very, very involved because, let's be honest, you know, while Pat Gillick has final say, which is true, Andy McPhail's the guy that's going to have to live with these trades for the next, you know, however many years he's going to be team president. So, you know, while they say Pat Gillick has final say, I almost feel like both of those guys are going to have to sign off on it. Because I think if Pat and Ruben are like, listen, I really like this trade for Jonathan Papelbon, and Andy looks at it and says, guys, I just don't see it. I'm not on board. I just have a hard time believing that they would go through. So I think it's going to be kind of a Gillick-McPhail collaboration over this next month.
This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks, everybody, for listening.